welcome to the Hermit's Lamp podcast. I'm Andrew McGregor, and with each installation in this podcast, we're going to explore the world of spirituality, what it means to be alive, and how is it that we can bring our spiritual selves, tarot, meditation, religious or spiritual practices, into our daily lives. Please check out all of our episodes at thehermitslamp.com/podcasts, or you can search The Hermit's Lamp in podcasts on iTunes and download them all directly that way. So while I've got you here listening to this podcast, I want to mention a new project that I am rolling out. Can you imagine working with a tarot that reflected you in your life? Can you imagine working with a deck where all of the imagery was tied to your specific experiences, imagery, and history? Can you imagine going through a six-month journey of working with each of the cards and being guided through a process to help reveal both their nature and your relationship to them? Well, if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, then I invite you to check out my new project called A Tarot of Yourself, and it can be found at thehermitslamp.com/tarotofyou. The first round of this project is going to start in September. However, at any point, you can jump in and start your own journey with this process. So do go and check it out, thehermitslamp.com/tarotofyou, all one word. So welcome to the next installment of the Hermit's Lamps podcast. Today I have rung the bat phone and got Thalassa on the line. And, you know, we're going to, well, I don't even know, actually. I basically reached out to Thalassa and said, "You seem fun. I like you online. Let's talk on the phone and have some shenanigans together." So we'll see where this goes. We'll see what comes up. So in case you don't know who Thalassa is, why don't you give them a little insight into who you are and what you're up to, Thalassa?
Ah, well, I'm part of the Trilateral Commission. No, that's not true. I am the founder of Daughters of Divination and the producer of the San Francisco Bay Area Tarot Symposium, the oldest established permanent floating tarot symposium in the world, literally. I've been reading and teaching and working with the tarot for centuries, it feels like. My primary claim to fame is that I've been doing these tarot-based events for 23 years now.
That's awesome. I personally can't wait till I can get out to the San Francisco area and come to one of these.
That would be great. We'd love to see you.
It'll happen at some point for sure. So before we were recording here, Thalassa and I were just sort of having our little chat, and I said, whoa, wait up. This is too interesting. I want to get this on film or on, you know, record this. So we were discussing reading for people and talking, you know, I was talking about how I've been doing a little bit less reading and more working on other projects and stuff. And then Thalassa was discussing her notions around the purpose of tarot, I guess we could put it, or her way of relating to tarot. And when she said the sentence, "You know, tarot is a pollutant for the groundwater of consensus reality," I thought, okay, let's talk about that. So tell me more. Tell me more. I want to know.
Well, I think that people who work the oracles and work them from a place of honesty and integrity really challenge the dominant paradigm, really work with a broader spectrum of life than what we're commonly used to. I think especially now, the way we live our lives is so narrow and so constrained. Everything is filtered through a screen. You know, we sit in front of screens and work. We go home and we watch screens. We have screens in the palm of our hands. For some of us here close to Silicon Valley, we have screens in front of our eyes. And that reliance on the conscious mind and the visual input limits your ability to fully participate in your life. It limits your connection to others. While I think reading tarot and other divination tools for others online or on the phone is useful. I think there's really no substitute to sitting down across a table from somebody with a deck of cards or a sack of runes or a pile of bones or that sort of thing. I think that human connection is so important. And our lives are increasingly isolated. You know, though I love, obviously, I'm all over Facebook, I love the fact that you can connect to people and you can form these bonds, and that's tremendous. But there really is, we're really wired to connect. We're really wired to be physically and spiritually and emotionally involved, not just mentally involved. And when you're working with a divination tool, you should be ideally triggering on as many cylinders as possible, to mix a metaphor, which I do a lot. I'm sort of like this Cuisinart of metaphors. You dump it in and there's God knows what happens. But I think one of the reasons why there's this resurgence of interest in divination, tarot, Lenormand, runes, wonderful to see the diaspora stuff, bones and shells and that sort of thing. I think it's because we realize unconsciously as a culture that we're impoverishing ourselves and we need that greater depth. We need that connection. And those of us who work the oracles are answering, I think, a call from the culture, you know, the call to help people, to connect with people. But not everyone uses divination the same way. And as I was talking about before we went on air, is I admire people who read. I mentioned, you know, how James Wells, you know, rolls up his shirt sleeves and gets into the trenches with people. Nancy Antonucci, there are a lot of these people, I just admire the heck out of them if they do that. And while I enjoy reading, and I like to think I'm a pretty good reader, I'm more interested in the study and the promotion and the, you know, putting on the events. And when I like to talk to large groups, I like to do parties, because you can do some wonderfully seditious stuff. You can get past people's ordinary defenses. You can touch them. You can connect them in a unique way. So reading as a vocation isn't really what I do, but there are other people who do, and it's wonderful. And I think there's when you really get going, especially with something like the tarot, it stimulates your creativity. I've watched people, you know, do plays, do music, do art, inspired and deepened and enriched by their connection to divination, especially tarot, because tarot is such an image-driven system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember catching, you know, on Facebook somewhere, Enrique saying, you know, reading the cards is one of the least interesting things you can do with them, you know, and I mean, it's provocative, but there's truth to that too, right? I think there are so many other exciting things that we can explore with them, and as well as using them as a language bridge or a symbolic bridge to help understand ourselves and other people in the world more, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, there are people like Art Rosengarten, and who's a Jungian psychologist, and Tony Gilbert, who's a nurse, who are trying to expand the use of tarot, especially, but divination, into healing people.
Mm-hmm.
I forget his name, but he wrote a book called The Science Delusion. And I haven't read it yet, but I love his premise that we're being preached a gospel of scientism. Now, I love science. Mm-hmm. I love flush toilets. I love electric lights. Cold champagne, the bomb.
Sure, you love Godzilla. I mean, we wouldn't have Godzilla without science.
Godzilla to science. So, see, but I think that the danger we run with any belief is that it limits our experience. And so, while science is great and scientific thinking is great, I think critical thinking is a necessity, and we have entirely too little of it. But the scientific worldview negates spirit, negates the deeper realms of human experience, and does so at a peril to us as individuals. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason the skeptics, it's almost like skepticism as a belief system, you know, love to poke fun at practitioners of magic or divination and that sort of thing, as if there's, you know, something wrong with exploring the deeper levels of the self. But we need that. It's what makes us human. And just because you say, oh, that it's ridiculous that you believe in spirits, doesn't mean that it's going to go away. You know, I always want to, you know, shake these people and say, okay, if you strip away God, if you strip away spirit, if you strip away all these things, what are you going to give people in its place? Mm-hmm. You know, yes, the universe is beautiful, but it's lofty and it's cold and huge, and that's not going to, it's like taking a child's teddy bear away.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, because there's all this stuff that promises things and then doesn't deliver them, right? You know,
right.
Science can't heal our existential crisis. I mean, you know, maybe Art Rosengarten would disagree with me on that one, but you know, but like science can't, certain kinds of science anyway, and certainly the science of facts and being right can't heal our spirit, and you know, like all that kind of stuff, right? Facebook. I mean, we're talking in some ways because of Facebook. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. perhaps I would have connected with you through my friendship with James or other ways, but it's certainly because of our connection online. But that's only a small slice of my participation there. And I think that, as in many things, I am a little atypical in my way of being on there, because I do reach out and connect with people and meet them in person or talk with them via Skype like we're doing or what have you. But, you know, there's this sort of promise of bringing us more, better everything. And yet it is isolating and undermines the sense of, I don't know, connection, faith, mystery, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, I live in San Francisco, so we're in the hotbed of technology. And you've got people who are trying to commodify everything, make everything electronic. There's an app for everything,
mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. And what happens is, you know, why? I wonder if we are on some level becoming increasingly afraid to live on the planet. We want to make ourselves smaller. We want to make ourselves more self-contained. So especially around here, you see so many people with their phone completely connected to their phones and unaware of what's going on around them, or, you know, the Google Glass, mm-hmm. which is a real problem around here,
right.
Because, you know, it's the ultimate, it's kind of like, oh gosh, anything I say is going to be really incendiary. So I'll just say that what.
Oh, set a fire. Set a fire.
I'm burning too many bridges as it is right now.
Fair
it's
enough.
Become this hobby of mine. It's like, okay, pull, pin, throw. But, you know, it's one of these things where you can observe everything but not participate.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got an entire culture that is so connected. It's like I always want to go up, especially since I take mass transit, I want to tap people on the shoulder and go, what are you doing? Yeah, I can see you. You know, what is so important right now that you have completely tuned out everything to the point where you don't even know where you are?
Mm-hmm.
I've just walked into you because I've been dodging and bobbing and weaving, but you keep bobbing and weaving absorbed in your phone. What is so important? You know, and especially in a city like San Francisco that's so gorgeous. It's like, why would you walk down the street, you know, with your attention nailed to a device?
Hmm.
And as wonderful as you mentioned, how wonderful it is to connect to people, you know, it's even more important nowadays to have things like BATS, like Reader Studio, to have these connecting events where people can put names to faces, where people can hug the people that they've been having these wonderful times with online. It's more important than ever because everything in our lives, you know, almost requires that we pull in and, you know, sort of, you know, form this relationship with a screen that isolates us. And, it's one of those things that how do we keep our humanity? How do we keep true to our wiring? Our DNA says that we're kind of wired for connection, physical connection. We're still primates. You know, we're still big brain monkeys with opposable thumbs.
Yeah.
And the DNA thing fascinates me because for years science said, "Oh, there's all this junk DNA." Can you hear my quotes around junk DNA? But what they're starting to believe is that DNA, that junk DNA, may actually be conveying things like memory. And that makes sense because for years I said, "Okay, why do animals do blah blah blah?" You say instinct. How is instinct conveyed, especially for species that don't have parental connections, you know, that are hatched or whatever, and they go about their business? How do they know where to go? Mm-hmm. Where is that information coming from? Well, it looks like it's in that junk DNA, and it explains so much. But that connection that we need, that connection we have, is in ourselves. It's in our atoms. Mm-hmm. And we ignore that at our peril.
Absolutely.
I have a few opinions.
That's great.
Which I cheerfully share.
This conversation reminds me of Terrence McKenna. Do you know Terrence McKenna?
I have read some of his work.
You know, Terrence McKenna, for people who don't know him, was a explorer of psychedelics, especially mushrooms, but other things as well. And he was, a big proponent of it, and did. He was a scientist, so he did a lot of research on it as well as a lot of personal exploration. And he released this wonderfully trippy album with him and a group called Space Time, where he's doing spoken word, and there's this like tripped out ambient music with didgeridoos and stuff like that. If you like that kind of thing at all, you should certainly check it out. You can find it on YouTube or wherever else. But in it, he says that history is ending because the dominator culture has led the human species into a blind alley. And as the inevitable catastrophe approaches, people look for metaphors and answers. Every time a culture gets into trouble, it casts itself back to the past, looking for the last sane moment it knew. You know, and his suggestion is that the last sane moment we knew was back before cultures, 15,000 years ago, when we were all nomadic people doing our thing that way, and he sort of goes on to suggest that what's being revealed is that the secret faith of modernism is not actually progress, but the secret thing that we come to in that is nostalgia for the archaic, nostalgic for the Paleolithic, and all of these things that come out of that, right? So. Anyways, and I see tarot as being in that, the way in which we are searching for new stories that are actually old stories that are connecting us to the archetypes that help us make sense of what is going on in the world.
Well, we carry stories. We are creatures of stories. We are our stories, both individually and collectively. I mean, one of the things that when you look back to where the tarot first appeared, those were images based in stories that the culture was telling itself. I don't believe in the thing that always kind of been used to me about. Now I've only read articles by Terrence McKenna. I've never read any of his books. He's as much of a golden ageist as anyone, somehow that we will, dissolve into this, primeval purity kind of thing.
Sure.
I believe that we are clever, big-brained monkeys with opposable thumbs, and we will figure a solution for everything. We will save ourselves. It may not look like salvation at the time, but we adapt. That's why we have managed to claw our way to the top of the food chain, is that we solve problems, we meet challenges, we reinvent ourselves. But we do that with, we come kind of factory sealed with stories, and we build on them. You know, it's like every culture has variants on certain stories, and the trappings change. I don't believe in archetype per se. Mm-hmm. I think there may be archetype could be viewed as a skeleton upon which the culture hangs flesh and clothing. So I don't believe there is, like, to use an example, the wise old man archetype, you know, a favorite of Jung's, doesn't carry the same weight now that it would have done even back in Jung's time. If you look at the image of the emperor, the earliest images of the emperor, he is an old man in armor. The implication is that he has won his place. He has accepted the duties and the responsibilities as well as the power. Mm-hmm. And he is willing to defend that. He has defended that. So, you know, this comes out of a period where if you've lived long enough to hold on to power long enough, that gives you a certain extra dimension to how you wield your power. Nowadays, we don't venerate age. We don't venerate experience. We're completely in the thrall of the shiny and the new. And so the image of an old wise woman or an old man in power doesn't have the same resonance. Mm-hmm. So you can't really call it an archetype. The archetype of old man, old woman, maybe is underneath all the cultural baggage, but it doesn't have the same resonance for us. So I tend to avoid the word archetype when I'm talking about the tarot, or stories for that matter, because culture changes things. Mm. It's like the Empress. One of my what started my transformation of my idea about the tarot was the Empress. From weight onward, you get the baby bump, you get the nurturing mother, you get the mother goddess crowned with stars. If you go back to the original images, you're talking of where women wielded power, mm-hmm. where you had like Catherine de Medici and Elizabeth I. And,
sure, we have the Popes, right?
Yeah, that's a different thing. The Empress is a woman.
Sorry, the
wielding
Empress. Yes, of course.
The Pavess is interesting as well because it's a woman wielding spiritual power, and in a world where supposedly the Pope was the be all and end all of spiritual power, there were female religious leaders. There were women who wielded spiritual power. Mm-hmm. And that's so subversive but so empowering, and that's what the High Priestess was originally about. But again, you get with weight this kind of virginal anima mundi tabula rasa kind of thing. And I think it takes some of the juice out of it. And the same thing with the Empress. You know, how does the feminine side wield power? How does a woman sit power? Thinking of the animus against Hillary Clinton. There are lots of people who cannot stand that she is whip smart and makes no concessions to feminine wiles. Mm-hmm. And so people feel very, very strongly about her. They're very, very strongly supportive of her, viciously opposed to her. That's what an archetype of female power is. And so I think when we lose that in the Empress image, we lose a huge dimension of what the Empress can convey, and we go to, oh, the mother and oh, this. Mm-hmm. Now, I will confess that my what got me going on this is that I had a dreadful mother, a lunatic mama, and so the idea of a nurturing mother is not something that I'm comfortable with. Mm. And so I'm reading about, you know, and I started with the tarot when I was like 12 or 13 years old, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm still being knocked into walls by my nurturing mother, and I'm looking at the mother image, and I'm like, and for years I hated the Empress. And the only way I could come at her was, she talks about the fecundity of the soul and the artistic manifestation of inspiration and that sort of thing. And then when I started seeing the older images and seeing a woman seated in power, it transformed the card for me. Mm-hmm. It transformed everything for me. So how we tell these stories, how we look at these images, can, you know, the more layers we add to it, the more effective it can be. I have gone off the rails. I don't know where I started on that one. But
that's all right. Well, you know, for me, the idea of archetypes is, to me, I see archetypes as this sort of thing where there's a variety of archetypes, and I don't tend to limit to be like, oh, well, the emperor is one archetype, or you know, and I certainly see this sort of historical flow where I think there is a wide range of archetypal notions that float through, and to some extent they are ultimately personal, right? My personal relationship to those archetypes is going to be different than other people's, you know, and that's where like Angelis Arian's work, which is very interesting, but I find it very hard to get into conversations about it because I find it reductivist. You know, I find the conversations that I end up in it about it reductionist in a way that to me starts to negate anything that feels helpful for me around that idea. So.
It's been years since I read Angie's book, so mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I recall when I read it. This is how bad my memory is and how long ago. I remember thinking, well, that's a way mm-hmm. to look at it. And you know, people can come up with. I mean, the tarot is so inspiring. You know the story of how Angie got involved with the tarot. Wonderful story. She was doing some research. She was an academic, and she was doing some research, and she went back in the stacks, and she opened this book, and she found Crowley's Tower. Well, if you've never seen Tarot, wow, that's an image. Mm-hmm. You know, even for those of us who work with it, you know, that the Thoth deck is so arresting in its imagery, and so, you know, that projective geometry. But, you know, I can't imagine if you've never seen any, you know, Tarot, and that's the card you see. And she brought it to the librarian and said, I found this in this book, and I don't think it belongs in this book. And the librarian snatched the card and threw it in the wastebasket and said, you don't need that. And, of course, Angie was very curious and mm-hmm. waited for her moment and, you know, snatched the card from the waist in and it started her journey. You know, she wanted to find out what this was. So, you know, she came at it from a different place. The beauty of what I love about Tarot is that it's so fluid. Mm-hmm. It is, there is no one holy Catholic apostolic. There is no ultimate authority. It remakes itself generation by generation, person by person. Sometimes somebody will say, oh, well, the Seven of Swords, you know what that's all about. And I said, well, no, for me, I love the Seven of Swords. I'm having a necklace made with the Seven of Swords mm-hmm. on it. Because to me, it's kind of George of the Jungle. It's kind of popsicle sticks and twine. It's the card of improvisation. Seven is the number of power and magic in the realm of air. And the Waite Smith imagery just cracks me up from the moment I saw it. I just loved it. It looked like this hyper dramatic, look what I'm doing. Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, 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 dun.
And I just thought that was such a wonderful thing. And I've always used that image as having to find creative workarounds, having to use your mind in a different way. I have a lot of training in improvisational theater and stand-up mm-hmm. comedy and that sort of thing. So to me, that's the Seven of Swords. It's like you're constantly bobbing and weaving, and you're not making, your trajectory is all over the map. But for other people, it's like, well, this is the Seven of Swords. And it's like, well, okay, you know, your mileage varies, but that, and that's okay. There is no, you know, world tarot board saying this is what it means.
You're not going to reach out and say, you know what, please give me your certified card back. I'm taking away your license to drive these cards.
Well, I tell people, my students, it's like, you know, I don't read reversals. I figure, you know, why do you need, you know, read, do what your mother said, read the card first. Mm-hmm. If it's upside down, it may not mean anything. Now, granted, I'm a Virgo, and so I like them all right side up. one of the few instances where I'm just a tad OCD. But I've told people, I said, you know, I'm not going to come to your house if I sense that you're reading reversals. You know, if reversals are what speak to you, that's great. Now, I personally like the old-fashioned dignified and ill-dignified, but that's because I tend to the ill-dignified under the best of circumstances. But, you know, it's one of those things that you, whatever you want to do, to whatever those things call you to do, then that's what you should do. I mean, that's what I was going back to what we were earlier talking about. If you are working the oracles from a place of deep honesty and integrity, you've got to hear the message.
Well, and I think that the idea that you will even arrive at, you know, your way of reading it, you know, the longer I read, the less that becomes true. The more it's like, well, generally I do this, except when I don't. You know, 25 years of reading, I never looked at a reversal. All of a sudden in the last year, reversals have been catching my interest for some reason. I'm like, all right, I'll let it go. You know, that process of it changing its story and changing its use and adapting over time, you know, of being a subversive force. I think it can even be a subversive force within our own history with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think you have to be willing to do that. I think you have to be willing to change and shift and grow with it. There have been times if I'm reading, I will literally, the card will say something to me as I'm reading it, and I will shift message. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, you're telling me this, and that's what I said. I've changed. Well, I don't use spreads so much as I throw the cards out there, and what those positions means alters sometimes moment by moment, because I go into this kind of light trance thing, and it's like whatever is speaking to me is telling me what that card means in that moment for that person in that position. In that moment, mm-hmm. And I find that it's a place of power, you know, where you're really surrendering yourself and letting all of your knowledge kind of form the crystal of the laser, you know, the light, the wisdom is hitting you, and the cards are kind of focusing it like the crystal does in a laser. And if you really open yourself to that, it can be an amazing experience. Now, it's not, you know, it doesn't mean that there are no absolutes, absolutely no absolutes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're really hitting, that's great, but it's not always going to hit. You know, it's like you have to be willing to say, okay, this is what I've said. Does that resonate? And there's always that dreadful moment when someone says, no, not at all.
Mm.
Ooh, I may have been reading for myself at that moment.
I don't know what you're talking about. That's not what's going on in my life at all. I really wanted to know, you know, whatever.
Well, and sometimes that's a dodge.
Sure.
And when you've read long enough, you can tell sometimes that's a dodge, or someone that's, you know, somebody's out of, disconnected from themselves enough. Sometimes they don't want to know, but sometimes you don't hit. I've been known to, you know, do my whole dog and pony show and go ta-da, and the person says, nope, that makes no sense. Okay, you know, well, then let's regroup and go back and see, and now let's go side by side and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. You know, in Toronto we have regulations against bringing animals into the workplace like that, so, you know, maybe that's part of the issue. No, 100% right. You know, the thing is, you know, what happens when the person kind of stares back at you blankly and goes, no, you know, and that's where experience and having a bunch of tools definitely comes in handy, right?
Well, yeah. And the thing of it is that there have been times where, in fact, I was doing a reading at Reader's Studio. So I'm reading for my peers, and I started out and I just stopped. I said, I don't think this is resonating for you, and I'm not I'm not getting that. And she said, you're right. I said, would you mind if we started all over again and see what we take? This may not be the time. This may not be the place. Mm-hmm. I will cheerfully, you know, give you your money back. I am willing to try again another time. But, you know, that's where experience comes in, from a sense of not having your ego tied up in it. Mm-hmm. To say, okay, I ain't feeling it. Shall we try some naughty French postcards and start all over again? Sorry, I have many things vulgar among them.
It's great,
but I just think that willingness to surrender to the moment, even if the moment is not obliging you,
yeah,
and just, you know, asking the querent, okay, do we want to start all over again? Do you want to give me some more information? You know, where do we go from here? Because in this moment, it's not working. And, you know, we're so enamored. We're always, humans are kind of enamored of hierarchies and experts and that sort of thing. But we have made a cult of expertism. It's like when we rush disaster relief to some area, along with the blankies and the bottled water, we're bringing experts to help people process their experience. Instead of asking your grandmama or you know, rooting around, you go to an expert. So there's this idea that somehow when you sit down across from a card reader, they have to be an expert, you know, and their word should carry this power. And I think that that's such a dangerous place for anyone to be in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll start right out saying, you know, I'm not here to dazzle you with my psychic prowess. I'm not here to impress you. I am here to help you. And, you know, how we do that will unfold as we step off on this journey together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hate pronouncements. I hate, you know, somebody saying that I am an expert. One of the things about bats, because for me now it's always coming back to bats, is that you can talk, no one is an expert. Everyone is in a place where they have various accumulations of knowledge. But even if you are a rank beginner, you can talk to Mary Greer as mm-hmm. a peer. And you know, Mary is so gracious and kind anyway, but you can have these wonderful informed conversations because you're not talking to the great and powerful Oz. You're talking to this human who has accumulated a wonderful amount of knowledge and is willing to share it and discuss it.
Yeah.
I think it's very powerful.
For sure. Yeah, last podcast in this series, in order anyway, was with Marcus and Tally, and we were discussing the same thing, how you go to a conference and everybody, at least in my experience, is accessible. It doesn't matter, you know, whether they're Mary Greer or James Wells or, you know, Rachel Pollack or, you know, Thalassa or whatever. You should go up, say hello and talk, and, you know, everybody's there for the same reason. And
no, with me, you actually have to make an appointment to talk.
Oh, do I? Oh, sorry. My forgiveness.
And you have to bring offerings, chocolate and champagne.
At the end, we will point out the secretary or guard or cabana boy or whoever it is that is handling the appointments at BATS to speak with Thalassa.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, people are so excited. And you know, this sort of thing about being somebody who steps into or works with or maybe is a pollutant in the groundwater of consensus reality, you know, we're all kind of outsiders, at least for the most part, in some way or
yeah.
other. And having
yeah.
that collection of spending time with people who are equally as outsider, you know, I go home and I tell my partner, I was like, oh, there was this great conversation, you know, with the Daughters of Divination today. And I just get this look that's like, uh-huh, you know, and then I describe it. And then it's like, oh. As long as you had fun, dear. You know, it's
yeah.
like, it's not quite it, but it's like, I don't understand it all. I'm like, good.
You well. Don't have to. That's all right.
Yeah.
But seriously, I had this vision at one of the early bats, you know, gathering. I mean, there's something so powerful when you're working with stuff, when you're in a room with like-minded souls. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's true whether you're a philatelist or an ophthalmologist or a tarotist, whatever, being in being with your tribe is so important. It is so nurturing and supportive, mm-hmm. ideally. And I was looking at this group, and, you know, this was when Bats was still kind of new and not very big, and I said, we are yeast. We're, each of us is a yeast. And each individual yeast is important, but what makes yeast even more important is how it works collectively. And we go out there, and we raise our little piece, patch of flower and water around us, strengthened mm-hmm. by our connection to one another. And, you know, then we smell funny and we burp, but, you know, that's a side effect.
It's part of our beauty.
It's part of our unique yeastiness.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes take a metaphor too far.
Well, that's what makes it funny, right? You just keep pushing at it until you end up somewhere else that makes sense, and then you go from there.
And then I go from there. That's part of the thing about the comedic mind is a transgressive mind. A comedic mind sees something and pokes at it and pushes beyond it. And it's really not necessarily something that you have conscious control over. But, you know, most comedians, you know, the source of humor is, you know, fear and anger and frustration, and it's a way of kind of shaking our little fly fists at a whimsical and frequently farting universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the mind of a comic. In fact, I finally got interested because I've been when did I do stand up? So long ago. But I got sort of interested in the process of how humor works and what you keep seeing in the comedic mind is this looking at something sideways and then pushing it a little farther. And the beauty of humor is that it flies under radar. It comes at you sideways. People will find themselves relaxing and being more receptive to something if it's delivered in a humorous way. I find it really interesting that now a lot of people that teach presentation skills and public speaking skills have finally figured out, you know, that if you know how to leaven your speech with a little humor, it will be a more effective speech.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when people laugh, it's a physiological thing. You relax a bit, and when you're relaxed, you're more receptive. You know, it's like when people talk about their favorite teachers, very often they will talk about their passion, their enthusiasm, but as often as not, they'll talk about their humor mm-hmm. because it makes learning a pleasure. I always loved it when I first started doing classes and appearing in like little cable closed captioning, you know, back in the misty reaches of the Paleolithic when we had little vanity television shows and things like that. And people would say, wow, you're so funny, but I actually learned something.
Mm-hmm.
Why, yes. That was my evil intention.
Well, clients who know me well, and I feel slightly bad that this is the case, but, you know, there's a certain moment, like when I'm reading with people and there's like, I'm looking to understand what's going on and I see the problem and I see this and I see, but I don't understand like maybe why it is the way it is or, you know, and so I'm like digging deeper through whatever means I'm doing that. And then there comes this moment where I realize exactly the way in which the person is thinking wrong and causing problems or exactly kind of how, whatever it is that they're doing to encourage themselves being stuck when that's happening. And I can't help myself. I start laughing. I just start chuckling. And, you know, people who've known me, you know, come for readings over the years, they're always like, uh-oh, this isn't going to be pleasant next. And people who don't know me at all are like, I don't understand why you're laughing. What's going on? I'm like, I'm sorry. I can't help it. It's just this, like, you know, moment of revelation, you know?
Well, I think the universe does laugh. Mm-hmm. It also kind of bats us around like cat toys. But I think that, you know, there are lots of, you know, like laughing Buddhas and laughing saints. I think Frankie, the current pope, one of the things that is so wonderful, there's a picture of him. There was a group that they were having a wedding, and they were and he's blessing the wedding, but somebody put a clown nose on him.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in fact, I'm in a bit of a, you know, oh God, I'm having another epiphany. I belong to the Epiphany of the Month Club.
Excellent.
Sometimes I get bonus shipments. Uh-huh. And what this one was like, somehow the next step of my journey involves a clown nose. Now at Bats, we always have a cauldron of clown noses so people can, you know, get, and they're safety wrapped, you know, for hygiene. You know, you don't want to use
for your convenience.
Yeah, sanitized for your convenience.
Mm-hmm.
But there are several groups that are using clown noses for a variety of purposes. But for some reason, so far the universe is not forthcoming. But I'm wondering if I'm being drawn into more humor and more silliness, because I think we're desperately in need of silliness and
mm-hmm.
humor and happiness. You know, it's like, look what we do to kids nowadays. Every moment scheduled, and you have to be thinking about college before you're even out of junior high, and you've got to do this stuff. And when I've noticed when I've read at parties where you've got a mix of generations, the younger folks don't know what to do because they've been told what to do, and they've had everything scheduled for them, and it's like, so, you know, how do I pursue a dream if I don't even know how to dream a dream?
Sure, or they're lost in their technology, right?
In their technology, and they're lost in being told what to do. And I think that, you know, silliness and humor and that sort of thing can kind of get in like, you know, melted butter in a scone or you know, a crumpet or something, you know, that it kind of gets in there and enables people to free up their thinking. So I don't know if I become, you know, the goofy messiah or, you know, I don't know.
Well, you know what?
Details to come.
I really like that. You can be the, you know, well, you can pick, certainly, but, you know, you can be the empress of laughter, and, you know, we can come up with, you know, like, you know, and the duchess of, you know, duchess of dirty jokes and
the
you know, whatever.
The
you
queen
know,
of clown noses.
As we're chatting today, a notion has come to me, and that notion is that every card has a joke in it. Every card is ridiculous and can be ridiculous and maybe should be ridiculous, and every
mm-hmm.
card could be a silliness as well. And you know, I want to invite anybody who cares to share with me, with us, with Thalassa, if you're on Facebook, you know, pick a card, especially one that doesn't seem like it's particularly humorous, and post a joke that goes with it or something like that. And, you know, either post it to the wall for the Hermit's Lamp or, you know, just tag us in it so that we can see that. Because I think that there are 78 jokes at least out there. And I think that it'd be wonderful to explore that and play with that.
Yeah, I love that. There's a picture I posted on my wall a while back, and it's this very tough-looking older woman with a cigarette sitting in front of a spread of cards with this kind of, like, what do you want look. And I thought, you know, that's a high priestess for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what do you want?
Definitely.
You know, these cards aren't going to read themselves, honey.
You better pour me a double gin and tonic if we're gonna have to talk about this. Let's go.
Yeah, come on, let's go. All mm-hmm. right, roll up our sleeves. So yeah, I think it's a great idea. I really think years ago, I mean, when I was still a doe-eyed lass and really had no business teaching tarot, one of the things I talked about, I would be making jokes, and people, especially, you know, back when in the medieval period when I was teaching, would say, well, you know, why are you making jokes? And I said, you know, if you cannot make a joke, it means that that has too much power over you. If you've ever noticed, totalitarian regimes and control junkies don't laugh, don't make jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody once called Mel Brooks on his, you know, making Hitler jokes and Holocaust jokes, and he said, you know, the laughing at someone like that strips them of their power.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that it's important to keep things in perspective. It's important to laugh. Laughing is very healing. I'm a certified laughter yoga trainer.
Nice.
Laughter, it's not so, it's a physical reflex. It does, you don't have to laugh at something funny for laughter yoga. You're basically doing, in fact, while I was going through my training, I lost two people, one through the cancer and one to suicide, while I'm going through my laughter yoga training. And
Bring on the joy.
But they're saying, you know, go ahead, laugh, cry. They're very, very close. They're both important. They're both release. It's the body is doing the same release mechanism. Just go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I was doing the laughter, and sometimes I was sobbing, but it was so healing.
Yes.
But laughter is, I think, important. You know, if you can't poke fun, if you can't say the emperor has no clothes, then you're allowing the forces of control to have too much power. Whenever somebody is really earnest and humorless, a little flag goes up in my head, because what happens is suddenly the map becomes the destination, the tool becomes the task. The way something is done becomes more important than what is done, and you've got to loosen it up. You've got to let that go. And laughing at something can be not in a cruel way.
But no.
It's like I dislike humor that is cruel. But there's still nothing wrong at taking a pot shot at some self-important bastard, puffing himself up and trying to oppress people's rights.
Mm-hmm.
Poking is good. Laughing. The gesture has always spoken truth to power.
Yes.
That's one of the things. When I did an essay about the fool, the fool has a variety of dimensions, one of which is just how the mad very often have an unvarnished connection to the universe in all of its rawness.
Mm-hmm.
But as the image went from the village outcast to the jester, that added another layer to it, which is that a jester can say what no one else can say.
Exactly. Only the jester can laugh at the king, right? Everyone else gets
right.
beheaded.
Well, you know, Shakespeare's fools. Shakespeare's mm-hmm. fools are all are invariably the wisest people in the plays. But, they're just fools.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard sometimes to take people who are funny seriously. I always think in Romeo and Juliet, when Mercutio is dying, people are still laughing because they don't realize that, you know, the just because you're the funny guy doesn't mean that you aren't also saying serious things. And Mercutio, even with his dying breath, encapsulates what's wrong with the feud between the Montagues and the Capulets. But he's been taking pot shots all along
mm-hmm.
at the situation.
Yeah.
Sorry, another digression brought to you at no additional charge.
Lovely. Well, unfortunately, I need to take us towards a diversion now and a separation as our time is kind of winding down to its end here.
Okay.
But where should people come look for you? Where would you like to the hordes of people who listen to this to descend with their humor and silliness into your orbit?
My website is www.dodivination.com, and that's about bats and that sort of thing. I am about to, after the symposium, to relaunch my Tarot blog, Tarot Pundit, and also I have a current blog that I haven't blogged on for a while called Travels with Thalassa, which is also my Facebook page. And Those are all ways of if you want to hear my rants. And one of my commitments to myself is that once BATS is done, I will start blogging again. Because this is my way of slouching towards Jerusalem. I mean, slouching towards the book. The working title of the book is The Goddamn Book. I've been working on the book for about 20 years, mm-hmm. but I'm inching closer. I figure if I start to blog again, which will be reviews and rants and opinions and that sort of thing, it will get me closer to the book.
Wonderful.
So those are the best way to be on Facebook. It's Travels with Thalassa. My Twitter feed is Bat Queen. There is also a page on Facebook, SS Bats, and a Twitter feed, SS Bats. I don't know that I'm going to be doing much after the symposium until we start up again. We're going to be doing some fundraising events in 2015, including a wonderful event that I did years ago and been wanting to revive called Shakespeare Magic and Tarot.
Lovely.
Which is a day-long event. So there's a lot in the offing. So those are the ways that you can follow those.
Fantastic.
Now, right now, there's not a lot happening. Tarot Pundit isn't up yet. Travels with Thalassa is up. There are a couple blogs there to read, but I haven't started contributing to that again. But the Travels with Thalassa Facebook page is like ruminations and quotes and pictures and stuff like that.
Perfect. Well, and I'll include some links in the blog post as well, so people can just click through to those things.
Well, thank you for putting up with me for an hour.
Oh, are you kidding? It was delightful. Thank you for being on here.
Okay.
So if you'd like to join us on this silly interpretation of each of the cards, please slide on over to The Hermit's Lamp on Facebook. That's facebook.com/The Hermit's Lamp. Or wherever you found this podcast, if you're hanging out on Facebook or wherever, post it in the comments. And certainly we'll take a look and laugh and joke and have some fun together. And do me a favor, if you know anyone who would enjoy this, please let them know. Please share it so that I can get more and more people involved in these conversations. Thanks a lot for listening.